Welcome back to the Bastionland podcast. As this is series three, we are exploring the rule of three, where each week I ask a new guest to tell me about the three tabletop games that are most important to them. Today, I'm joined by one half of the most dangerous duo in RPG / party game design. Welcome to the show from Tuesday Night Games, Alan Girding. Hi, Alan.
Chris, that intro's so cool. So cool. You have such a smooth, silky voice. I'm so pumped right now, not just because I'm here hanging out with you, but because of you being my hype man. That was great. Thank you.
I did have like a marginally insulting one prepared that I thought, well, you know, Alan likes a joke. He'll appreciate this one.
Sure. Are you being sincere? Do you have it?
Well, you know, maybe we'll say that for the end. I'll do that for the outro.
If you're just messing with me and you don't have it,
no, genuinely, like, you have to realize that I am like a horrible person. So my whenever I'm writing these introductions, if I know the person well enough, I do like to slip in a sort of self-deprecating dig.
Yeah.
Affectionate dig, rather, I should say. But I thought I'd play it safe, but we'll bring that back for the outro. I'll keep that.
Let's do it.
I've got that side.
My family treats me like crap. No, that's not true. I have a childhood development pattern of my family giving me a really hard time. So I have very thick skin, I'd like to believe. So I'm all for it.
We'll test that out later then.
Yeah. Yeah. You're part of my family now. I'll just call you dad. If it's really mean, you're my dad.
So without giving away your choices that you've picked, what was your process for choosing three games that are most important to you?
Well, true man behind the curtain reveal, you said ideally at least one of them would be a role-playing game. That was just very apropos because the first one I thought of was definitely a role-playing game. Most of my hours of my creative day are thinking about role-playing games. Truth be told, even though our company, Tuesday Night Games, publishes only Mothership at this point as far as the role-playing game.
Yeah, I think because Sean is so vocal about role-playing games, I always just sort of assume that you are like the board game guy out of the two of you.
I am the board game guy out of the two of us, but we'll find out today as I talk about these games that I got into board game as kind of a fallback from role-playing games. And that story, I'm sure, will unfold as we talk today because it's an old, tired story and my entry into the board gaming world. But that is exactly the case. The big difference between myself and Sean when it comes to the role-playing game aspect is he's really steeped into the community, where I'm more of that creeper in the background where I subscribe to the YouTube videos of role players. I have so many freaking role-playing games sitting behind me right now, shelves full of different modules and systems, etc. And I love just reading supplement materials because it's like, it's almost like cliff notes into novels, except you get to write your own stories in your head. I could just go on and on and on for a while, but Sean and I's relationship is strongly built upon a love for role-playing games where we talk for hours and eventually our partners have to stop us like, hey, could you pay attention to us for a little bit and stop talking to your other business partner / lover? Because it's getting annoying. We'd really like your attention. But anyway, so I immediately thought of one game, and it's my story of how I just basically fell into role-playing games. But then for my third, that was the challenge. The challenge was, okay, I need like a legitimate, more contemporary board game that maybe has really influenced my game design. And then when I finally thought of it, I realized, oh, duh, this is it. And it still doesn't really, I don't think I'll please anybody, nor do I think I'll piss off anybody with my choices today. But that was my basic process.
Awesome. So I think without any more delay then, let's get on to your first choice. So what game have you chosen for your first game?
It's not original. I'm pretty sure that my first choice is a lot of individuals' first choice, especially in my age range. My contemporaries probably have a shared love for HeroQuest from Milton Bradley. And I want to say that's like 1988, maybe 1990. I haven't looked it up in a while. But I remember very well one of my favorite Christmases. I have this big box I'm opening up from my father for Christmas. And I open it up and it says HeroQuest. Never heard of it. But of course, I'm automatically transported by the immersive and detailed box art that is very adult-esque. I mean, it's horror slash adventure, has the flexing barbarian. Ah, there's battle going on, undead skeletons everywhere. Flip the box over. It only gets sweeter because then you see the promise of a beautiful board with 3D pop-up miniatures, furniture, doorways, not just closed doors, also open doors, and then minis galore, orcs, skeletons. What the heck is this big gargoyle figure? What? I can't wait to dive in. So I open it up, and it's my first real experience with anything that's even slightly role-playing, because I would go over to my cousin's home, and he would have the red box Dungeons and Dragons, and we would create characters all the time. It was something that I loved to do. And this is before I could even really read and write well. He would have to help me understand a lot of the words. I remember this so well. And plus, my cousin was 5 years older than me. And so there was this whole like, oh, I'm one of the big kids. I'm making a Dungeons and Dragons characters. I don't even know what this is, but it sounds amazing. But we never actually got to play. I just made these characters. So here, HeroQuest, it was kind of satisfying that need. But Chris, I hope you can appreciate this. I'm the youngest in my family. My older brother is Chris. My cousin Justin, I just talked about, he's 5 years older than me. And most of my friends growing up were my brother's friends. That typical little brother that would tag along saying, me too, guys, me too. Are we going outside? Yes, you too. Because I was this fat kid. So first of all, I was younger. So I didn't have the social immersion that my brother did. You know, you don't have kindergartners asking each other to spend the night, that kind of thing. My brother brought his friends over first, etc. So there was definitely this admiration going on. But when I got to open HeroQuest, it was so visually compelling that sure enough, my brother said, what's that? And so did his friends and my cousin, like, what is this? And so I got to be Zargon the Wizard, which is the equivalent of the Dungeon Master.
Ah, so you ran it.
I ran it. And so now not only am I the youngest, but I'm in control and I have power and I'm like the popular kid all of a sudden, even though by popular kid, I mean, I had four other players, one of which was my brother.
The dream. I would have settled for four players for a long time.
Oh yeah. But we had the four players and we ran through all 14 missions beginning to end, not in one fell playthrough. That would be insane. But we did this, and I cannot tell you enough how that just plunged me face first and drowned me into the geekery of board games, miniatures, and eventually more and more into role-playing games.
And I think that's, you've said that this is probably a common choice. Yeah, you're the first person to choose this game so far.
In any of the three, no one's mentioned HeroQuest?
No, so you're the final episode of this series. So there's been 21 choices before you, seven guests doing three choices each.
Wow.
And yeah, you're the first person, I think, to choose HeroQuest. The exception is I have a similar story to yours. I think I even mentioned this on your last time we spoke when I was on your podcast. And I've repeated this story so many times, but it's like, people expect it now. It's like, this is my stairway to heaven. People are going to be shouting for me to tell this story about when I got handed down a copy of HeroQuest from an older cousin. And by this point, I'd already played Warhammer Quest, which was in many ways kind of a sort of successor to HeroQuest, more complex.
Yes.
But getting HeroQuest, I kind of liked that it was simpler and everything, but there were two things missing from this box that I got handed down. So I was very impressed with all the furniture and I was impressed with the, you know, the box art and the board. But the two things that were missing were...
Don't say the gargoyle.
The gargoyle.
No! Yeah!
So I could see on the box that there was... And it, you know, I by this point I played Warhammer, so I knew that this was basically a bloodthirster. So I was thinking, oh, this is great. I'm going to have a really cool, like, bloodthirster miniature.
Now, to be clear,
gargoyle.
When you say Warhammer, so sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
When you say Warhammer, do you mean the Warhammer Fantasy Battle?
Or
do you mean Warhammer Quest?
Well, both, to be honest. But I got my start in Warhammer Fantasy Battle.
Okay, go on. So sorry. Just want to have a frame of reference.
Don't try and turn this into my three choices. I know what you're trying to do.
Okay.
But yeah, I so the gargoyle was missing, which was, you know, that's bad. But I did have other miniatures that I could, you know, I could bring to the table if I needed to.
Right.
But the adventure book, or the scenario book, whatever it was called.
Oh, that's right. I remember this story now. Yes. Yeah. This is so good. That was the other thing that was missing.
Yeah. So I had all this, so I could run the game, but I didn't have any like scenarios. So we just had to make it up. And, you know, I've joked before that this was my first time GMing, essentially, because I would just like, my friend would go around the dungeon and I would just, he'd walk into a room and I'd say, right, well, there's, you know, two orcs and there's this fireplace, and the fireplace would always be a trap. But my, you know, it was just a running joke. So my friend would always send a character up to look into the fireplace and get burnt alive. But, but yeah, and it was, it says a lot about the furniture and the board and the whole design of that game, that you almost can't help but make like an interesting dungeon just by putting stuff on the board.
Yeah.
It's very easy to just lose yourself in that dungeon, even without all of the, you know, all of the, I assume in the adventurer's book, there was all this background and stuff as well that I was missing out on.
Lightly, very lightly, but there was an interesting ongoing narrative of the Witch Lord. There was a recurring villain there, and that's why they had the Return of the Witch Lord expansion, which was really cool, because lesson learned for those creating games, that was the highlight of our play session, was the recurring evil character of the Witch Lord. And so that campaign aspect of it, along with the campaign aspect of keeping your equipment from level to level, that is what kept our players coming back for more and more. Going back to your story, though, because, man, you coming up with your own examples and your own adventures, what a story, because that has to take some creativity and really scratch that itch. But I have to ask you, Chris, did you partake in Hasbro's upcoming re-release of HeroQuest?
I did not, no. I try to avoid all this, you know, Kickstarter madness with these big board games. I'm kind of always of the logic. I worry that if I buy one of these big, you know, big Kickstarter releases, I worry that I'll end up spending thousands of pounds.
Right.
But so I always tell myself is that, well, if it's good, then I'll hear about it in a few years' time. I'll just buy it then, which it's not always easy to do that. But
right.
that's what I tell myself loudly. So I was kind of tempted, because I thought, because, you know, I'm still good friends with the friend who I was playing with back then when we were like 10 years old. So I thought, oh, shall I get that? And we'll like, we can play it together and it'll be like a bit of a nostalgia trip. But no, I didn't. Did you?
I absolutely did. I absolutely did. I'm totally with you. That I was a former Kickstarter addict. In fact, you would be challenged to find anyone who backed more projects than me. And it was a big reputation I had, to the point where a lot of people might be asking, who are you, Alan Girding? Because, again, a big part of my identity to a lot of people, definitely within the industry, was I backed so many projects. It was a huge part of my credit card bill, was always Kickstarter projects. But during quarantine, I have pretty much almost altogether stopped. COVID put a stop to a lot of things. And one thing it put a stop to was my Kickstarter addiction, because here I have this basement that is overwhelmed with board games. It's disgusting. You'd think I was a board game reviewer with the amount of games I have. And so many of them are in that classic shelf of shame, or some people call it like shelf of opportunity, where I have games still in their shrink wrap.
Oh, no.
But when it came to HeroQuest, my attitude was condoms and handguns, where it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. I just thought, I am too nostalgic. I have too much love for HeroQuest not to get the re-release, just for no better reason than maybe to crap all over it about how it totally does an unfair thing. And here's something I shouldn't share. This is, maybe this will get you the views or really bite me in the butt. But as a board game designer, my ultimate game design, my personal favorite design that I've done years ago, and it is a modified version of HeroQuest. And I basically said, I miss HeroQuest, and I think there's so many other HeroQuest wannabes, including Descent and Gloomhaven is the more popular one nowadays, obviously. And I don't want to crap on those games, but none of them gave me the same nostalgic feel of HeroQuest. And everyone has their complaints. When you play HeroQuest today, it is dated. There's definitely some things like the randomization of movement, etc. There are some things. And so I modified HeroQuest, and I called it HeroQuick because basically it made it a speed game of sorts. And I'm not going to be able to sell it or do it service. But I am very glad that no one else has come out with a revised HeroQuest that has incorporated my rules. I don't think anything has. And I know I'm almost patting myself on the back to the point where I'm breaking my arm here. But I hope at some point that our company, Tuesday Night Games, can publish our first $1 million Kickstarter miniatures type of game. HeroQuick is the tentative name right now. I'm not sure what that would mean for copyrights and trademarks and things like that. But basically, it's HeroQuest on fast forward, where it's distilled down to its most fun aspects without the tedious aspects of it. But anyway, point being is, yes, of course, I had to buy the latest HeroQuest just to see if they were going to incorporate any new rules, if there are any changes, learning as much as I can, but also just to see how they handle the furniture, everything. I just can't have it, for no better reason than an art piece. I have to have HeroQuest on my shelf at all times. I wish I was so wealthy that I had all the possible expansions, because they have like the Barbarian pack and the, I think like the Elf pack. And those things on eBay to this day still go for almost $1,000.
Oh, wow.
And they're insane. Like, there's one pack that comes with like ice giants and different barbarian variants. And I don't even know if they're good at all. And the only reason I would get them is just for that whole Pokemon addiction of, I gotta catch them all.
So what is it that you think? Because I was thinking about this with relation to, I liked Warhammer Quest a lot and I liked HeroQuest a lot when I was growing up. And I have tried Gloomhaven. And yeah, I'm not going to shit all over Gloomhaven because I enjoyed it, but I kind of realized after about 10 games or so that it wasn't really for me, and I wasn't expecting it to scratch the exact same itch as HeroQuest. But what is it about HeroQuest that you think is missing from like things like, I would say like more modern designs like Gloomhaven, Descent?
Yeah.
You know, those sort of games. What's missing for you?
It's a great question, and it's a difficult one to answer. I think the main thing is it's an impossible comparison. I'm a huge fan of the YouTube show Toy Galaxy. Toy Galaxy reviews all of these cartoons from the 80s, the golden age of where marketing and television was totally intermixed for children, where if there was a cartoon, there was a toy. And the problem that a lot of cartoons have with revitalization, including the Ninja Turtles, anything else that's come back, Thundercats, is everybody from the old school original gangster fan base say, not as good, not as good, because the reason we loved it so much is the nostalgia. So the biggest thing that HeroQuest going for it is the simple nostalgia of it all. And you can't compete with that because it's nostalgia. It's from our past. It's part of our childhood. It's part of our development. We have these fond memories we've put on a pedestal of things that have happened in our past that have brought us so much happiness. And it's almost one of these things, I call it the labyrinth effect. I know a lot of people will really hate me for saying this, because don't get me wrong, I love me some David Bowie, and I love King Jareth, and there's some classic things about Labyrinth. But I hadn't seen Labyrinth since I was a child. It'd been almost 30 years since I'd seen Labyrinth. Plot spoiler, I'm in my 40s. But I decided, and this was years ago, I was like, you know what? I haven't seen Labyrinth since it was freaking brand new on VHS in my basement at home. My parents just wanted to shut me up and keep me occupied for 2 hours. I love this movie so much. I'm so excited to watch it again. And it didn't hold up. It holds up in the adult aspect of nostalgia. And it holds up in the fact that Jim Henson's studio did an amazing job with all the puppeteering. It makes me miss it as far as like, wow, they really went all out with these abilities. And I miss David Bowie, huge David Bowie fan. Hmm. But the story, shit, it's just so bad. And there's all these real like nonsense. It doesn't make sense. If there's so many holes in the story, I'm like, it doesn't hold up. And so it kind of tarnished my memory of Labyrinth. Cause as a kid, not only was I impressed with David Bowie and King Jareth, and Jennifer Connelly is still one of my faves to this day. But anyway, that all still holds up. But as a kid, I thought the story was perfect. The acting was perfect. I thought everything was perfect. It is not. So, you know, there's almost this labyrinth effect, as I call it, where when you revisit something old, it tarnishes your memory of it. Like, oh man, I put this on a pedestal unnecessarily.
So the big question, I guess, is have you revisited HeroQuest recently?
Yes, I have. And there is a bit of the labyrinth effect, where I realize, okay, this isn't necessarily better than Descent or Gloomhaven, even though I think Gloomhaven with its card mechanic is so different that it's almost in new category.
Definitely.
It's not like a dungeon crawl, tabletop, whatever you want to call the genre of HeroQuest.
I guess like a dungeon crawler.
Yeah, dungeon crawl mini,
I suppose.
Anyway, it's hard to compare them because, again, the mechanics are so differently. But HeroQuest with the roll to move, HeroQuest with the door grinder problem. Do you know what I'm talking about here? Here's the solution.
I forget how doors work. So the wait, you just stand in the doorway to like, yeah, so you use it like a bottleneck sort of thing.
Exactly. And you just put two people on other sides, they come out, they can attack. And so you just go ahead, bottleneck. So you can just totally stranglehold all of the creatures if you want to. You pinch them into a corner because the wizard can attack diagonally with his staff, but nobody else can. So the ideal formation is like barbarian, dwarf on the two orthogonal sides, wizard in the diagonal, pin the gargoyle in the corner if you can. Anyway, so there's all these broken strategies, mechanics, and it's slow. It's really slow. One game takes an hour, sometimes two, and there's plenty of turns where it's just people moving and nothing's happening.
Because I was going to come out in defense of roll to move, because I feel like it's one of these things that everybody, as soon as they see a game that has roll to move, they're like, oh, look, it's broken. That's a bad mechanic, you know, trademark. We don't use roll to move anymore. But I feel like, I don't know, I wonder if I'm just being being contrarian, but I feel like the roll to move was part of it. And the fact that it had this kind of slightly familiar feel if you played, you know, family board games. I think that's it creates a certain feel when you're doing roll to move. I don't know. You're not crazy.
It has that Ameritrash feel, but I think that still goes under the category of nostalgia because when you roll to move, you're like, oh yeah, this is just like freaking Clue as opposed to Cluedo. It adds that randomness. But one of the big rules in game design is if it can happen, it will happen. And sure enough, you can have three turns in a row where someone rolls snake eyes. They're like, this is bullshit. I just moved six spaces in the last 20 minutes. This is crap, man. Now I got to wait for my turn after moving two spaces.
Yeah. To be fair, I'm probably being kinder to it because when we played, I played most of it just with like a single friend. So one of us would be all four characters. And then it's not so bad. If your dwarf is lagging behind, then it becomes like just a funny thing that's happening when you've got three other characters you can be playing with. But yeah, when you're playing with one character each, I can see that.
I think there's a compromise. The easy compromise is instead of rolling 2d6s, you move like 5 plus 1d6. So you always get 5 movement plus a d6 or something like that. Or maybe you make it customized. And I'm kind of revealing a little bit about my hero quick modification. But basically, like the dwarf would have a base move that's slower than the elf. Like the elf would be 6 plus d6. The dwarf would be 1 plus d6.
Or give them the choice. So say you could move, I can't remember, if 2d6 is the standard move, say you can move six squares. Yeah, you can move 6 squares or you can roll. So that you've got a bit of an interesting choice there. So you still got you can make a dash for it, but you might just fall flat on your face.
I like that.
You can use that for Mother Quest or whatever it's going to be called. Come to Kickstarter next year.
I love Mother Quest is so brilliant. Just make it Hero Quest, but it's in the mothership world. Oh man, stolen. I love it. You're so kind, Chris, to not crap on Gloomhaven. I can't either because I'm a big advocate that no one should crap on anything that other people enjoy. But I also like to hear people's feedback on certain things and why their experiences weren't ideal, for no better reason than to inform my own game design in the future. For me, Gloomhaven, I made it about 10 games again. And first I was thrilled. It was definitely crunchy, not necessarily smooth and elegant at first. There's a learning curve to it.
Oh yeah.
But our session got into the sewer level. And I think that's about 10 missions in, maybe only six. But once we got into the sewer level and there was slime where it restricted your movement, and I was the brute character who relies on being able to ram into people. So speed is really important to damage other individuals when you're the brute. It soured our experience. Like, we just did not have fun. It was just like, this actually feels like work. I feel like I should actually be outside weeding my garden right now instead of playing this game, because they're equating to the same amount of work and satisfaction, to the point where I have a game table, one of those classic game tables from gametables.com, where you play on the table, but then you can cover it up with the official tabletop so you can use it as a dining room table. Mm. That level is still set up and buried under the tabletop. No. And it's been over 2 years. It's been since like a year before quarantine. And I'm almost embarrassed that my Gloomhaven is still set up in that level down the basement, have never come back.
See, I was playing the new version, the Jaws of the Lion, which is more accessible and quicker setup.
Ooh, I have not played.
Yeah, so I was kind of on board with it. And I think what I was missing, and this isn't fair, because I think I was wanting it to be something that it wasn't, essentially. And I think that's the problem with lots of, and you know, like I say, I can see why it's the most popular game in the world on Board Game Geek and all this stuff. But I think I was, when I get thinking about like, oh, it's a bit like a dungeon crawler, I was kind of hoping for like a bit more of some kind of exploration and like the sense of surprise, because that's what, when I think back to what made HeroQuest fun.
Absolutely.
It was that sense of like, what's around the corner. And
absolutely,
especially because we were just making it up. So we would just pull out random miniatures.
And you could just, did you plan out the adventures ahead of time, or would you improv room by room and just?
Oh, no, we used to just improv it at the time. I didn't like draw out the map and do like proper GM prep. I used to just, you know, my friend would go around the corner and enter the room, and I'd just put down whatever felt right at the time.
Yeah.
And when we could see that, you know, he needed to go home to have his dinner in 10 minutes, then maybe you just throw out all the monsters because you know that he's leaving. You know, it was that kind of mood, definitely.
Right.
So yeah, I think my issue with Gloomhaven was that I was expecting it. I was looking for something that it wasn't even claiming to offer, frankly.
And I think that is the answer to your original question, is does HeroQuest still compete with Gloomhaven Descent? One is the nostalgia factor. So it's unfair comparison because of nostalgia, as I already said. But the other is the simplicity, the ease of accessibility. When playing HeroQuest, I have taught my players how to play it as we're playing the game. So we'll just start and they're like, all right, you start here. All right, what do I do now? Now you roll the dice. You move that much. Well, that's easy. Well, I'm at a door. What do I do now? You can open it for free, but be warned, when you open a door, you reveal everything that's potentially in the next room or what's in your line of sight in the hallway. Okay, that makes sense. And so they're learning as they play it. So it's very accessible. The other thing is, you already nailed the Fog of War. So I think that's what a lot of the other games, because when it comes to Descent and even Gloomhaven, it's like, oh, you want to play Descent? Here's the explanation. It's going to take realistically an hour full of explaining and trial and error and answering questions before people get into the flow of it, at least, I would say. HeroQuest, all you have to do is set it up right out of the box, ready to go.
That's it. Your second choice, you mentioned that your second choice was going to reference Warhammer Quest, but your choice isn't Warhammer Quest. So explain yourself.
So we start with HeroQuest. We get the taste, the addiction. It's in our veins. Is there anything else out there, like something we can level up? Advanced HeroQuest comes up. We get Advanced HeroQuest. It introduces round miniatures, round bases for our miniatures, Skaven. That's kind of cool. What's this? Modular board. Instead of having a singular board, now there's modular. This is interesting. Let me read the rules. Too complicated. Classic line nowadays. Too long, didn't read. We're like, not sure. But I had Advanced HeroQuest. But then someone says, check out Warhammer Quest. It's HeroQuest, but enormous. So we start playing Warhammer Quest. And it's incredible. It no longer has the door problem because the door frames are two squares wide. It also has the modular board where you go from room to room. It did have the element of you have to add your own miniatures to continue.
Oh, as, yeah, yeah.
As a side note, my insane cousin Scott became obsessed with, he was more into collecting than he was playing any of these games. And what he wanted to do, he wanted to get Warhammer Quest and every single miniature that's in the freaking huge
in those
novel.
Encounter things.
Yes. And he,
yeah,
he,
I was talking about this recently. I had the exact same thoughts.
He did it. He managed. Oh, wow. He has, and you have to understand, he did this in the 2000s. So this is, I'm going achronistic here as far as how the story goes. So this is just a side note about my cousin, Scott. Mm. So he had to go through eBay. The publishers and even the sculptors know my cousin Scott by name because he was so active in the eBay online community of gathering these miniatures. Because not only did he get them, but he also got them still in their package and then he got them all signed. My cousin Scott, he's leaving this in his will. It's still in his basement, has an open copy of Warhammer Quest and he's modified it so it has all of these miniatures in there, still in their cases, etc. And then obviously they can't all fit in there, but he has a miniatures box. It's insane how he's done this. And I don't even want to guess how much that would go for. But imagine just launching an eBay where it says, here's a complete mint copy of Warhammer Quest, along with every single official miniature that you'll ever need. What?
Wow.
That's a total aside story. Going back to the chronology of the growing addiction, we got into Warhammer Quest. And Warhammer Quest had these additional rules that if you wanted to, you could start adding more role-playing aspects to it, where you could do stat checks, etc. And so we started diving into that a little bit. And that eventually grew the interest into this world of Warhammer. And that led me to my second choice, which is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, the role-playing game that I by far played the most up until our own company's mothership came. I spent years playing Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, learned all the lore, learned all the rules. I got in specifically with second edition. And man, I have so many memories and I've learned so many lessons because it got so popular. Eventually I had 12 people around the table. And so I learned the hard way, like, no, try to keep it to like four players, wow, yeah. Maybe six. 12 is getting crazy because my friends had never played any role-playing game and they started telling her other friends. And eventually it was like, we all got to play Warhammer Fantasy. And then it was just nothing got accomplished. But man, so many hours in a Warhammer Fantasy roleplay. Have you ever played?
So it was my first actual RPG that I ever picked up, sort of before I really knew what RPGs were, because in the UK especially, Games Workshop has this huge monopoly on, like, well, or certainly did before the internet.
Right.
It had this, you know, as far as I was aware, as like a, you know, 10-year-old kid, Games Workshop made these games and that was kind of it. And I was loosely aware of Dungeons and Dragons as a name of something. But it was never something that I would see for sale in a Games Workshop at that time, because this was after they sort of stopped selling other companies' games. So I was at one of the Games Day conventions here in the UK. So it was like the big Games Workshop convention each year, and I saw this was tucked away on a tiny table in one of the side rooms with I think it was Hogshead Publishing was the name of the company that published it at the time.
Sounds familiar. Yes.
Yeah. And this was
eventually Green Ronin Publishing did second edition mostly, I think.
Yeah. So this was before the second edition. This would have been like mid to late 90s.
Got it.
And yep. So I think I was about 12 years old, and it was, I had a kind of similar experience to you where I was just blown away by how much stuff was in here and like all the possibilities, all the different careers, all of the, you know, the critical hit tables and the weird magic results. So I did try and run it, but I never really successfully ran it for more than like, I did like one or two sessions, like playing on a forum in like the early 2000s, playing on like a message board, because my friends, it was too much for my friends at the time. You know, I had friends that I could play Warhammer Quest with and play the tabletop games, but this was just, it was kind of too much for me to run as well. I think I just found it so daunting, because if this is the only RPG that you've ever really picked up and you've not played D&D, it's quite a hill to climb up to get to the point where you understand how it works as a game.
I would argue that Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, certainly second edition, and even today's fourth edition, is an easier pill to swallow intuitively than Dungeons & Dragons, which is crazy because Dungeons & Dragons is the name. People think role-playing Dungeons & Dragons. Some people even use Dungeons & Dragons in replacement of tabletop role-playing games. Oh, we were doing some Dungeons & Dragons. That's not a verb, man. But anyway, that's the idea of Dungeons & Dragons being so huge. And I just played 5th edition this past weekend. The quick story is my friend was supposed to get married, but then he called off the wedding 30 days before he got married. So we already, he had the venue or whatever. He's like, well, let's just do a party there instead. And so we ended up playing 5th edition. And I'm looking into 5th edition, and I'd read the rules before, but man, I realized this is not as intuitive as, I'll even say the D100 system of Warhammer Fantasy is way more intuitive for any plebeian than Dungeons & Dragons D20 system. In the D20 system, you just roll a D20, you're like, all right, I got a 16. That's high, so that's good, right? I want to get higher, like, yeah. But with a D100 system, if I say you have a strength of 50% and you're rolling a strength check, you intuitively know, oh, that's 50%. I have a 50-50 chance of succeeding here. You understand the percentages more intuitively in that way. So my argument is, I think Warhammer Fantasy is much mechanically easier to enter than Dungeons and Dragons. However, thematically, certainly not. Because it even has a tagline, grim and perilous adventure. Death is around every corner. It's basically Call of Cthulhu meets Dungeons and Dragons. I hear a lot of people explain it that way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, but the thing is, I was already deep into Warhammer by this point. So the Warhammer element appealed to me. But even then, there was a clear difference between what I saw in this book and what I was seeing in the Warhammer Fantasy Battles of the time, which I think would have been, I want to say, like 4th edition of the tabletop game. So it was still quite an early version in the grand scheme of things. But this was like so much darker. And this book was quite old when I bought it, I think. I think it was like on the edge of going out of print. So it has weird things in it. Like, it doesn't have all of the chaos gods. And it has like Malal as like an extra chaos god.
Right.
And it's got just weird stuff like that. So at the time,
and famously, the inventory system and economy is totally broken in first and second edition. I remember very well our first game when I was not confident in my identity as a GM yet for role playing games. So I stuck to the rules by the book. Big beginner's mistake. And I had one of my friends rolled a halfling character and they got their equipment and they said, well, according to the encumbrance rules, I can't move even with my starting equipment. Like, well, that's not good. She couldn't even carry her anything more than her weapon and clothing, basically. So I was like, all right, we got to change this. So there was definitely some broken things, which almost added to some of the allure. I love it. I love me some Warhammer Fantasy.
I think I would, perhaps I need to go back and run it and like complete the circle, because I've never given it like a fair chance at a table with like other players. So yeah, I think you've inspired me to consider going back and running this as it is and seeing.
Well, let's be clear with setting expectations, because the best thing about Warhammer Fantasy is the story and the world, by far, in my opinion. Mechanically, with second edition and even some fourth edition, which is the current one, the combat slows down. And that's been my huge complaint about most role-playing games. Because even the original Dungeons & Dragons, it started as modified rules for chainmail, which was the tabletop combat. And therefore, a lot of people don't even realize that when you get into combat mode and have to leave narrative mode, that is basically the relics of an old system that had two games that were butting it into one another. Are we playing a narrative game or are we playing a combat game? Well, we're trying to play both, but you just have to violently switch gears from one to the other. And combat was so long and boring and mathematical with Warhammer Fantasy Second Edition, what I played most, that my players ended up avoiding combat more so, not because it was so lethal, but because it was so boring too.
Yeah, that's the danger, isn't it?
Yeah, they were so into the story. Like, I don't want to stop the story. I want to keep on going on our Scooby-Doo mystery of corruption and curses. I don't want to have to deal with finding out if I rolled more damage than they have armor and then modifying it correctly with my math skills. So, and here's another aside. The thing is, I'm so grateful for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and the amount of time I had with it. As I think most people have this identity experience, because I'm a psychology professor as my day job. I love the job. And we talk about identity theory. It's a big thing with Eric Erickson. We go through different stages of life. And arguably one of the most important stages is the stage 5, where you learn who you are. But there's these stages of identity. There's like identity diffusion, identity moratorium. There's all these different labels for trying to achieve identity. But one of the healthy things to understand is your identity is a process. You are supposed to try different identities out before you finally land on one that feels really comfortable. That's why your adolescence is so confusing, but memorable. Is one day you're trying on a different fashion trend. The next day, maybe you're hanging out with a different friend set. You are trying on different personalities like masks. The reason I bring this up, I think it's the same thing when you're starting to DM games. When you're a dungeon master, game master, warden, whatever you call it in your game system, you are learning what works for you. And everything I am today when it comes to a role-playing game designer and player comes from all of the trial and error mistakes, triumphs, tribulations from the years of me playing Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. It's why I love Theater of the Mind. I love the elegance of having invisible dice. As soon as you start number crunching and you're looking at your dice more than your thoughts are immersed in the story and what you're trying to accomplish, failure in my mind. And I know that's my opinion, but that's also what bothered me this past weekend when I was playing Dungeons and Dragons 5th Edition, is when we got to combat, our one fight took, no exaggeration, 3 hours. And I was just like, that's not acceptable to me. Not acceptable.
So the obvious solution is to sort of play something like, I don't know, maybe like Electric Bastion Land or something, where the combat's very quick.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, as you can see, obviously, that's a, yeah, the long combats are a problem that is very close to my heart, because I've probably gone too far the other way. But I think the thing for me is when I'm playing a role-playing game, So for instance, when I'm playing Gloomhaven, the stuff that I did enjoy about it was, you know, the tactical challenge and the card, you know, the way that you use your cards to, right, like, synergize with each other. And it was fun. And it didn't feel at all like a role-playing game, which is not a bad thing. It felt like a, you know, it felt like a tactical combat exercise, which is kind of what it is. But if I'm playing a role-playing game where there's a GM and I can say any kind of stupid stuff that I want to do and any kind of weird plan, It's that's what I want to be spending time doing, rather than doing this kind of mini Gloomhaven in the middle of my, you know, crazy scheme game.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think for me it's a case of like, make the main thing the main thing. And, you know, if I want to play a war game, I'll play that. But if I want to play a role playing game with a GM, I really want to like lean in on that side of things.
You nailed it, Chris. It's an identity crisis. What does your game want to be? More importantly, what do your players want to play? Do they want to play a tactical miniatures game? Then play a tactical miniatures game. Or do you want to play a story-based game? Do you want to play a role-playing game? Then let's play a role-playing game. I agree.
So, with we've had a board game and we've had a role-playing game. So are you ready to reveal your third choice?
Third choice is something that itself may have an identity crisis, because I don't know if you'd call it a board game, tabletop game.
Yeah, that's slightly deceptive of me. But yeah, tabletop game, let's see.
Tabletop game. Maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's not even a role-playing game.
Yeah, true. It doesn't need a table. But yeah.
What is it? I think it's just the social game of Werewolf, aka Mafia. When I had people over for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and it got too big and it just fell apart, well, what do we do? What do we play? I have a very steeped history of having people over weekly, and inevitably, when nighttime came around, especially in the warm weather, we would have a campfire outside. They would all start chanting, "Werewolf, werewolf." It was the most popular thing that a group of friends, seven more players, always wanted to do. And I love playing werewolf, the classic hidden game of who amongst you is a werewolf. You got the day phase, you got the night phase. During the day, everyone talks and choose someone to eliminate. Hopefully you're eliminating the werewolf and you win the game. Night phase, everyone closes their eyes except for the werewolf. Werewolf chooses someone to eliminate. Game goes on, fewer and fewer and fewer players. Flawed, classic, wonderful, very steeped in a lot of house rules and tradition. How one person runs werewolf, totally different than how another person runs werewolf. I didn't even realize there were card games because I had been playing this thing every week for almost, I think, like 13 years before I even found out that there were published card versions of it. I found out about the seer and how there are these other roles. We just did classic werewolf and villagers and people loved it. Of course, I added in my own flair of like, okay, what's your job here at the town? What's our town's name? Give a short description. So people really hammed up the whole social aspect of like, hey, I'm Chris. I'm the town butcher. I really just slice up that meat. Inevitably, there was always like the town drunk. The classic job that people say is I'm the merkin maker. You need a merkin? I'm going to knit one for you. Anyway, big part of werewolf. And that is what my game nights really led into were these social games of werewolf.
So it's interesting that you just played it with just villagers and werewolves for that long.
Well, I would say it was probably it was years of just doing it with that. We found out about the seer role and we did that. And we did add in some ones, like we did a lover's one too, which we just kind of house ruled. So I can't say, I came up with my own roles because they weren't very original in that other people had parallel thinking, whatever you want to call it. But when we did find out about all of the additional roles, my players, again, that nostalgia had already fallen in love with just werewolves and villagers and seer, that their tolerance for fancier roles was a mixed bag. Some people loved them, some people hated them. So we ended up traditionally alternating what kind of roles we did. One night or one week, we would just do plain vanilla werewolf. Then eventually we'd start saying, all right, let's go crazy here. We're going to have a hunter. We're going to have a witch. We're going to have a Dr. Boom. We're going to throw in a whole bunch of crazy characters. But yeah, originally it was just werewolf and villagers.
Because my background with werewolf is I became familiar with it quite a long time ago, but then I don't think I really tried it out until sort of years later. And then quite soon after trying it, I discovered, there's One Night Ultimate Werewolf.
Yes.
Which I'm assuming you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And for me, it kind of scratches a different sort of itch, because it's the whole point of it is that, again, getting back to the how impatient I am about combat in a role-playing game, is like it condenses it down to like 5 minutes and it's a very different, slightly different experience. But the thing that really works for me is this whole sense that you can, it's like picking from a menu, isn't it? Where you can say, yeah, we are just going to run with the real simple, just villagers and werewolf. Or you could say, we're going to have all this crazy stuff. And if you try it, it doesn't work. It's kind of the game that keeps on giving, isn't it? And there's not many games. There's lots of games that have modular components, but there's not many where the modules are so innately tied to the game itself. And sort of the modules have such a big, big impact. And I'm guessing this was a big influence for you, obviously, with Two Rooms and a Boom.
Absolutely. In fact, the long story of Two Rooms and a Boom is more about my relationship with Sean McCoy. We met each other and we instantly hit it off and became friends. We met at the Gamma Trade Show in Las Vegas. It's similar to like, because I imagine, Chris, and I'm not trying to crush on you too hard, but anytime I talk to you, I feel, man, I could talk to this guy forever about everything because we have such a similar base of interest. And it was that way with Sean, where we just couldn't shut up. We were just taking turns, like geeking about this, geeking about that, while walking around Vegas, going to all these crazy shows. It was like an episode out of The Bachelor, and we were the perfect match, where we basically said, you can send all the other contestants home. We're picking each other. Final rose, final choice. Sean McCoy, Alan Girding. Let's do this. Sean had never played any social games before. He never had played Resistance. He had never played Werewolf. He had never played anything like it. And at the time, pretty much those were your two options. When Sean and I met, there was the Resistance and there was Werewolf. And that was pretty much, maybe you could say 7-Up, heads down 7-Up, some people call it. Maybe you could consider that. But for the most part, people only could name Werewolf and the Resistance. And through our time hanging together, I played Werewolf with him. And he saw me host a game of Werewolf. And he, I can't exaggerate this, his enthusiasm, where he came to me, he literally grabbed me and shook me and said, that was awesome. Oh my God, how did I not know this game existed? Let's play again and again and again. It was like I just introduced him to heroin, not to de-romanticize this story, but he wanted more and more and more. And eventually he came to me and he said, hey, you and I, we should team up and we should make a game like Werewolf, like Resistance. I said, cool. If we were to do that, I would want it to be quicker than Werewolf, because Werewolf's biggest problem is that it can take forever. It also has player elimination. So I kind of started with my complaints. Like, if we're going to do this, get rid of player elimination. What would be really nice is if you don't need a host, so everyone can play. And the big thing with Resistance is it's the friendship ruiner. Resistance, sometimes I've argued, should be called Let's End Our Friendship. Because in Resistance, you are faced oftentimes with the concrete knowledge that you know someone is on Team Evil and you're on Team Good. And then what it comes down to is you two have to face off in front of the entire group, trying to convince everyone which one of you is innocent. Like, I'm not the evil person. They're the evil person, etc. I'm not the clone. They're the clone. Shoot him. It's basically that scenario. And that can get very heated very easily.
And it's kind of futile as well. Like there's so many times it comes down to that. And it is just your word against theirs.
Exactly. So it's really difficult. So we want to address these problems, but I specifically told Sean, because I was already in this game design world and was pitching my game designs to publishers, he said, hey, I have this idea. Let's do a hidden role game about a bank heist where there's like two different groups, like the hostages and you have the bank robbers. And maybe there's like two different play areas. And I said, time out. Do you want to work together on this? Is this a gift that you're giving me? Do you want to collaborate on something? Or is this your game you just want me to help you with? And I learned early on that you need to be very clear with expectations, because inevitably, let's suppose someone give you an idea, then they come back to you really angry, like, hey, I deserve some type of comeuppance or payback. Sure, yeah. You have to establish that right on. He said, I want to work with you. I want to see if we can publish something together. Cool. And then Two Rooms and a Boom came from that. And Two Rooms and a Boom, no host necessary, although you can play with one and it helps. Time limit. Each game has 3 to 5 rounds, which are timed. And the big thing was it brought people, I feel, brings people together more than breaks them apart. Have you ever played? You don't have to lie. Have you ever played Two Rooms and a Boom?
So my history with Two Rooms and a Boom is I saw it a long time ago, probably from Shut Up and Sit Down's coverage, I think. And I completely forgot that it was related to Tuesday Night Games. And then I later on, when I sort of started hearing about Sean talking about Mothership, and I sort of started speaking to Sean and then got in touch with you about doing the podcast, I'd sort of forgotten that you had also done that game. So when I found out, it was like, oh, these guys also did this game. But my history with it is I wanted to buy a copy, and unfortunately it was out of print for quite a long time. I'm sorry for embarrassing you and putting you on the spot here.
If I was embarrassed by that at this point, I would no longer be talking to you. I'm sure. Yeah, this is our MO.
So I keep I have several decks of playing cards that are blank, like bicycle cards. And so I was going to be going and meeting up with some friends, and I thought, I'm going to make my own copy of Tombs and Boom. So I have a bootleg hand-drawn copy.
Excellent.
Where I just wrote the words like president and bomber on some cards and yep. in Sharpie. So I still have that downstairs somewhere. But I'm yet to actually play it. I've not had a chance to play it yet. And obviously this last year has been not ideal for two rooms and a
pin. Now you're preaching to the choir. Absolutely. Yeah. With isolation, quarantine, a game that requires touching where you're passing cards to one another.
Yeah.
I should say requires vicarious touching. There's no way that it can really thrive in this current.
Sure. But yeah, so I'm not just saying this, but I do really want to try it out. But I've so far not yet had the opportunity. The part of the problem is that my main gaming environment is there's like a gaming club in near me, and we only have one giant room. So we could do two tables and a boom.
Yeah, you can do it in one area and just split up, because the rooms don't actually have to be rooms. The rule is you're just not supposed to be able to communicate with one another. And that's the thing. It's totally cool if you can see each other, but I totally get it.
Maybe I'll do that. Maybe then next time I go, when I'm able to go back to the gaming group, I'm gonna take my bootleg copy.
Chris, I'm not here to shake you down. Anyone can get the game for free. First of all, you can download it for free on our website. I've had to make bootleg copies on the fly sometimes I'll go someplace without a copy of Two Rooms and a Boom, and then people are like, oh, it's Two Rooms and a Boom guy, let's play Two Rooms and a Boom. I don't have it. I got a deck of playing cards. Sure, let me Sharpie that up and here we go, let's play. But also, it's fine if you never play the game. It's quite all right. But the reason I bring it up is it, in its essence, boiled down to its purest form, the game is you finding people on your team and working together. So it's realistically a team-based cooperative game at its core. So at the end of the game, even if you lose, you're not solely holding that burden on your shoulders. You're sharing it with your team. It's like, we tried. And when you win, like, we did it. It's we, yay. And so I feel that most games of Two Rooms and a Boom, and most people's experience with Two Rooms and a Boom, is after a game, they feel closer to each other as opposed to further apart from one another. And that was our goal. And that was very much influenced by Werewolf Resistance and other social games. And it's also at the core of how Sean and I are now in our epic romance together with Tuesday Night Games.
So this whole genre of games of sort of like social deduction and these very social party games, that there's been since Two Rooms and a Boom, that there's been hundreds of other games that are obviously following in your wake. Other than Two Rooms and a Boom and Werewolf, do you have another favorite that you could recommend to somebody?
As far as social games,
always looking. Yeah, like a social game with a bit of deception, maybe. So something that's in that same kind of space. Is there anything else that you particularly like?
I mean, I could totally just be a shill for myself and tell you that there's other games that I've designed. For instance, I host a weekend Halloween event at a castle in Ohio. It's Ravenwood Castle. We do it every Halloween. I also do it in March or May. It's called Weekend Werewolf. So it's an entire weekend full of nothing but these games, because I got the itch. Once we designed Two Rooms and a Boom, I've designed a lot of other social games. But that's a little too masturbatory for me. I don't want to self-promote. I would say Mafia de Cuba. I enjoy Mafia de Cuba because that's quick and simple. I think Don Eskridge is actually, again, this is going to sound like a self-promotion. Don Eskridge is coming onto our Tuesday night playcast, which is our live show that we do every Tuesday night at 8:30 East Standard Time. And on YouTube, he's going to be our guest this week. I don't know when you're going to air this, so I shouldn't say that. I'll say
it's going to be next Monday. This is going to be a very quick turnaround.
Well, he's coming on tomorrow. So on our latest episode, at the time of this recording, Don Eskridge, the designer of The Resistance, is going to be a guest, and he's sharing his latest project, which he's calling Hand 21. At least at the time of this recording, he's calling it Hand 21. And this is 21 social hand games, games that you can play just using your hands, which is brilliant.
Ah, nice.
So imagine you show up to some location and you don't have any games whatsoever. Mm. These are these classic folklore games. And I'm not sure if you know any. For instance, I know like Bear Swipe, Touch Your Nose. There's like 007, Three Thirds of a Ghost. I'm not sure if you've heard of any of these classics.
This sounds like absolute gibberish to me, but I'm massively intrigued. So I'll be tuning in to this for sure.
There's a whole bunch. I mean, I could just geek out and tell you about some of my favorites or whatever. There's a whole bunch of folklore games, games that you play without any components. Werewolf / Mafia is one of them. You don't need any cards or components for Werewolf. But anyways, he's come up with 21 hand games in 21. And a lot of these are social hidden role games. One of them, I think, is called Good Guys, Bad Guys. I'm not sure. You can find out on the show. But what you do is, it's as simple as you get a group of people around in a circle and you just have someone, a host who can play, say, all right, everyone, close your eyes. Open your eyes if you want to be a bad guy and look around. All right, there's your fellow bad guy players. And so it's totally your choice as a player if you want to open your eyes or not. Okay, time's up. Everyone close your eyes. Everyone open your eyes and you start voting people off just like in Werewolf. Yes, it has player elimination. That's no good. But here's the simplicity of it. Good guys win as soon as all bad guys are eliminated. Bad guys win as soon as there's only two bad guys remaining. So bad guy, let's suppose everyone opens their eyes and everyone's bad guys. Now it's just a popularity contest of like, all right, who do we eliminate until there's just two of us left?
Sure.
But that's brilliant. And so I love these very simple, easy accessible, no materials required type of games. So I'm pretty excited about that as well. So
that sounds awesome.
Mafia de Cuba, one of them. I got another game coming out, hopefully within the next year, called Cause of Death Ghost, which is very Mafia de Cuba-esque. There's a lot of these social games out there, and I really recommend, yeah, that. Oh, you know what? So sorry that I'm such a rambler here. I would really recommend Insider or Fake Artist Goes to New York, both from Oink Games. I think those are brilliant hidden role games. Absolutely brilliant. Have you played either of those?
I've seen Fake Artist in New York, and I think, again, continuing the theme of not buying people's games, I think I have like tried that out with some friends just using a pen, like using some pens and paper. But that it's definitely on my wish list, that one, because that's, yeah, it's, if you, the idea of combining hidden role with Pictionary, essentially, I know it's not quite that simple, but
I think that's a very fair comparison. Yeah, absolutely.
That as a starting point is a lot of fun. But speaking of Don Eskridge, have you played Black Hole Council from him?
I own it. It's on my shelf of shame. I've never played it.
I would recommend it because that's my one. If, again, if people are after something different, I think the problem with this one is, you know, you're saying about like these games that are hidden role games that leave you with a good feeling at the end. I think this one that probably does leave some people with a bad feeling. I am slightly afraid, but not necessarily in a bad way. I think that's okay with the right group. But yeah, that's another one that's worth checking out if you like the idea of, you know, being on an argumentative council, which, you know, isn't that the dream of everybody?
No, it is not actually the dream, because that's my big thing. And I know this makes me sound like a sourpuss, but I love contagious positivity. I'm a humanist at heart, and I believe that everyone's trying to do their best. And I think the purpose of getting together isn't necessarily to feel like you're a winner and you've won. It's to feel closer to those people with whom you just shared a memorable experience. So again, I think paramount in my ideal game design is players walk away happier than when they first got together.
Yeah, I think I agree with you completely, but I think I probably do just have a little bit of a dark side. I think
a lot of people do. To that. Yeah, there's a lot
of
people
making people feel bad. Yeah, it's a weird one because it's, anyway, I'm not going to sit and explain the whole rules for Black Hole Council, but I think if you get a chance to check it out, I'd be interested to know your thoughts on that one.
I will try to crack it open as soon as I get a chance to get people around.
Yeah, it's very touchy as well. Like there's lots of people touching the same card, so it's perhaps one for down the line. For
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think Secret Hitler, just to finalize that, even though a lot of people find the theme problematic, I think Secret Hitler does a good job of diffusion of blame. For instance, the issue with the resistance is there's concrete knowledge that you have of who is on Team Evil. And therefore, you get in that head-to-head conflict. Secret Hitler is that perfect Venn diagram overlap of complete random no-knowledge werewolf and absolute knowledge of resistance, because there is a benefit of the doubt with Secret Hitler. When you're on Team Evil, you play down cards that either succeed missions or fail missions, basically, in a generic explanation.
Yeah.
But you could explain to people, I drew three cards. All three were evil. I had no choice. I had to play an evil card. And people could not believe you, but at least there is room for that doubt.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm not sure if you played Secret Hitler before as well, but that answers your question of social role games, hidden role games, etc., that I've enjoyed. I think it all comes down to what floats your boat the most.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's it. Because I'm trying to think. I'm trying to save a little bit of my reputation as a non-terrible person by trying to think about what was it about Black Hole Council that I enjoyed. And the thing with it is that there's no traitor. So you each have your own like secret agenda.
Yeah.
And they're all it's the thing that I'm very impressed with, which I know this is just like a math trick, but it still really impresses me, is that it's calculated so that your agenda. So there are different colored planets, and each of you will want to either blow up certain planets or settle certain planets or tax certain colored planets. And the way it works out is no matter how many players you have, you will always have the same amount of crossover with every other player. So if you've got six players around the table and you've got sort of five objectives on your card, every other player will have at least one objective in common with you. So there's always a sort of deal to be made, and there's always a middle ground that can be reached. And it's interesting because when you're playing the game, it can feel like the person next to you, it feels like you were cooperating with them through the entire game, whereas the person opposite you was like they were your nemesis and you couldn't agree with them on anything.
Right.
But then when you sort of reveal at the end, I remember the first time we looked at it and I said, hang on, because I just assumed it was like random. And I thought, oh, well, maybe this person's just got more objectives in common with me. But then we sort of looked at it and we were like, yeah, we've all got the exact same. There's some sort of deep philosophical message in here about how we can all compromise and we can all reach some kind of agreement. Anyway.
Is that possible in the game? Is it possible that everyone can win?
No. So there is still a case of like whoever has fulfilled their agenda to the fullest, essentially.
So is this like a classic, there's only so many seats in the escape pod type of situation?
No. So each round you're drawing out like five different colored planets, and one person is the chairman, and that person is the only person that can put planets in different spaces. And there's one space for, I think it's settle. And there's one space for tax. There's one space for mine, I think. And then there's one for blow it up. And so I might have a card in front of me that says I want to settle red planets and mine green planets. And you might have that you want to mine green planets, but you want to blow up the red planets.
But you have to convince the chairman to do that on your behalf. Like, hey, put that planet in there.
Yeah, but only the chairman can move. So the chairman's like, wait, how does this look to everyone? And then half the table will say, yeah, that's great. And half the table will say, no, move this around. And then you move one thing and half the table say, no, put it back. And you have to get a majority. And if you fail to get a majority, then it goes to the next player. And the chairman role is constantly passed around.
My goodness.
And it's chaotic. It's good with like the full eight players. But you're kind of incentivized to say yes, because if the vote just keeps failing, then nobody gets anything, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I've got to tell you, like, I really respect Don Eskridge. That game sounds like it would be my bane, just because by definition, there's going to be some people that really, really would probably walk away going, man, I didn't get anything I wanted. Why wouldn't any of you listen to me? There's a game called Dead Last, which is one of the meanest games ever. And the story that I probably shouldn't share is that the designer of the game Dead Last contacted Sean and myself and said, hey, we think you'd really like our game. We think you'd want to publish it. And I wrote back after reading the rules and assessing it saying, this seems like you've got a really strong game here. However, Sean and I are trying to make games that make people have a very communal experience. And this one seems like it could be very mean, because the game Dead Last is simply you vote for people to be eliminated and hope you're not the person who doesn't get eliminated. Wow. That's an oversimplification, but basically it means you have to silently communicate with people who you want to eliminate. And then there's this vote, we're simultaneous. And inevitably what happens is someone says, whoa, almost all of you voted for me, because if you don't vote for the majority vote, you are also eliminated. So it's like everybody has to vote for the same person to be eliminated, because if you're not on that gravy train, you're kicked off.
No.
So inevitably the player who gets eliminated says, whoa, almost all of you voted for me? I didn't know. They're like, yeah, we all had this secret little communication behind your back about kicking you out of here that you didn't know about. Oh, well, that's great. Thanks for...
Oh, no. This sounds like Twitter the game. I'm not interested in this.
Yeah, it's middle school. It's total middle school all over again. I'm like, oh, so everyone's making fun of me behind my back. All right. This feels horrible. Okay. Anyway, yeah. So
I can see. It's like you say, isn't it? It's about the expectation. I think there's certain groups that would absolutely relish that.
Yeah. Some people love to see other people lose more than win themselves.
Yeah. Exactly. Anyway, I would happily keep on poking you for these social deduction games, but I might just ask you for a list by email afterwards, because I'd like to move on to looking at your three choices. And what I always try and do is I always try and look at if there's any sort of common connection between the three. And there's an obvious kind of connection in the sense that they form a kind of a timeline of your, you know, your history through different...
Yes.
Like we say, through board games to role-playing games to kind of social games.
Yeah. It's almost like a personality profile, like a Rorschach I just provided you, where you're going through like, oh, this makes sense. I understand you more now. It's very
interesting. Yeah, exactly.
You're good at what you do, Mr. McDowell.
But the thing is that I was like, my first thought was like, oh, well, and they're all quite simple games. You know, Werewolf is kind of the essence of that kind of style of game. It's a very kind of distilled game, and you know, Hero Quest is very straightforward, but Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay is not straightforward. I know you're saying it's simpler than D&D, but you know, I've got the book here on my desk, and that was the sound of the that was the sound of the book hitting my desk.
Yeah.
So it's not, I wouldn't call it a simple game, but no. But yeah, so in terms of that kind of simplicity, do you feel like you still kind of ride the whole spectrum of enjoying the simple games and the complex games, or
no.
Do you find yourself going a particular way now that you've matured into your gaming taste?
It's funny. I have said on numerous occasions publicly, I actually don't like games. I don't. I'm a horrible advocator for tabletop games, because I'm not there for the games. I'm there for the social lubrication that they provide. I'm there for the stories and the memories they provide. I'm there to have an experience that I'll potentially remember forever. And rarely, rarely do I think back, man, do you remember that one game of Risk I won in the late 80s? Oh man, I really had my friend on the ropes and I really circumnavigated their armies. Like, those stories are so far and few between, if they exist at all. Instead, what I remember are the stories of, do you remember when Josh laughed his ass off so much that he almost passed out and it was contagious and everyone else started laughing? Do you remember? And instead, the stories that people tend to share have almost nothing to do with the game mechanics and everything to do with the social interaction between players around the table. And that's the job of a game. And so I'm all about elegance. Elegance in the classic definition applied to game design, in that you have very simple decisions, but each of the decisions have a lot of depth and impact to them. You don't want to provide someone with so many decisions that they get overwhelmed and frustrated. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. There's too many decisions. And you don't want decisions to be superficial, where they don't really mean anything. So I really, and I think the exception to that, by the way, Chris, is role-playing games. Role-playing games is this big exception where most people's memories of role-playing games, again, is that perfect Venn diagram overlap of memories of the experience with players, but they always seem to be integrated into the story. Do you remember when we walked into the tavern and there was the drunk man that would not let go of his whiskey bottle and we needed to get his ID badge? We just couldn't get it off him. And then Robin had the idea, let's just cut his hand off. Do you remember that? So there's like this amazing overlap of what's happening in the game and how you're socially interacting with each other around the table. Anyway, so I am definitely in the camp of the game should never get in the way of the social dynamic. If anything, it's just that lubricant to promote it.
Yeah, there's that famous quote from, I always say it's Sid Meier, but I'm not sure, about how a game is a series of interesting decisions or interesting choices. And I agree with that if for something like playing Civilization on the PC, you know, on my own in the dark. But I think whenever I think about that and try and apply that to sort of tabletop games that I'm designing for, you know, five people sat around a table, I'll kind of come around to the idea that a game is a series of interesting conversations, which is a very pretentious thing to say. But like, it is those conversations that come out of the game that really stick with you. Like, I mean, we played, you and Sean played Electric Bastion and
so fun. At the so end of the year. Fun.
But I bet you, I wouldn't be surprised if you don't remember too many of the rules. Not that there are many. But like, I don't remember. Oh, remember the time.
I can tell you exactly what I remember from that game. I remember the story. I remember it, the ending of having the wish bottle and being able to transform into a giant. I think I was even transformed into a dragon and basically smashed the mansion to hell as I got Sean out of there.
I remember the two of you. I remember the two of you talking about these. There were these frozen statue heads that were like chanting and things like that.
Yeah.
And the things that I remember are the sort of the two of you either asking me like what's going on or like talking between yourselves and trying to get to it. And it is that kind of social lubrication. Like, I remember, this is going to make it sound like I had an incredibly luxurious upbringing, but the house that I grew up in, my dad, the way he tells it is he just got this from some bloke down the pub. Sorry, that's the most English sentence I've ever said. From some he said that he got this from some bloke down the pub, and it was a pool table that we had in our cellar in our house. And when I was a kid, I was like, this is amazing. Like, we have a pool table. We must be living like some kind of millionaires. But I think in reality, a pub was probably closing down, and my dad said, oh, we'll take that pool table because we've got a house that has a cellar with nothing in it. And the thing is, like, I remember I would always go and like, I would very occasionally go down and play pool, but it turns out playing pool on your own is not that fun. But if I'm out on a night out with friends and there's a pool table and one of them wants to play pool, like, I will play it every time. So I would say pool is a great game, but if you put me in a room with a pool table, I'm not going to have a great amount of time. And I think that's kind of a better fit for these tabletop games, is to think more like you're designing the next pool or the next darts rather than trying to design the next Sid Meier's Civilization that fits on a table.
Brilliant, Chris.
Yeah, for me anyway.
This is why I love pub games that have been so culturally ingrained that people can play them on autopilot, like a simple game of poker or hearts or spades that you've played around the family table so long that you no longer have to ask rules questions. It's all just happening around in the background of your brain, which enables you to just talk as filler between it and only occasionally say, hey, it's your turn. We're waiting for you, whatever that may be. Yes. Mm. Yes. So, so poignant. So well said.
I have a list of projects that are on my back burner. Well, I have lots of projects on my back burner, but then right at the bottom of my back burner list is to write a book of games that could be played with coins and dice and a deck of cards, like a pub games book, which I know is already a thing, but I feel like that would be a fun challenge, just like trying to write. I'd try and do 100 because I'm a glutton for punishment, but...
Yeah, wow, that's tough.
Yeah, so I've tried a few and it turns out it's actually really difficult because there's nowhere to hide. Like, you've got to just make the game kind of work. You can't just put a lot of silly words in there and hope that people don't notice.
Yeah.
I can see the appeal, definitely. Well, that's brilliant. Thanks for coming and sharing your choice is Sean. That's, oh, sorry, hang on. My notes are from before Sean cancelled and I had to get you instead.
That's Sean. Woohoo! Mr. Cancel.
That was going to be my insulting introduction. I was going to introduce Sean and then say, oh, I'm sorry, I've just heard Sean can't make it. So
it's not insulting to me at all. It's incredibly validating in a strong way. Because trust me, Sean's my best friend. I love him so much, but that's brilliant. And I think he's gotten that in reverse so many times. It's only fair that I would get that thrown my way.
Oh, that's
too.
Good then. I'm glad that I'm balancing things out.
Yeah. 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 Because as you said, I'm more known as the tabletop guy. And we started with our tabletop games. And it wasn't until recently that we released Mothership. And so only then is Sean getting more of the limelight. So I'm really glad. So I'm very happy for Sean and his success with Mothership. Trust me, if for no more selfish reason than the amount of hours I've played Mothership and have talked about Mothership with Sean. Oh my goodness, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, for people who do want to find out more about your games and the stuff that you do with Tuesday Night Games, where can they go?
My main advice is just go to TuesdayNightGames.com. That's night with a K. We're also on social media. We're on Twitter at @playTKG. Me personally, I would go ahead and search us out on YouTube because we like to post YouTube videos about what's going on. And we have a show that's every Tuesday night. We call it the Tuesday Night Playcast because we also play a game every Tuesday night. And it's live, so you can comment on it or watch some old episodes.
So thank you again to Alan for joining me, and thank you to everybody at home for listening. As always, you can keep up to date with everything Bastionland at bastionland.com, where there are links to the Discord server, Twitch and YouTube channels, and to Patreon, where you can help to support this podcast. And a special thank you to all 8 guests that have joined me for the Rule of Three. And I hope that you've all enjoyed listening to this third series. Bastionland podcast will return, but it's goodbye for now.